You've been investing, I think, for almost 2 decades now.
More than 2 decades, 23 years.
23 years. How much longer do you think you will keep investing?
Well, I can't imagine I'll ever do anything else. So, and I'm definitely someone who is motivated by, and when I say motivated, I mean I actually truly enjoy the process of working with entrepreneurs. So I think it'll be a long time. One of the measures is that venture capital funds, when one raises a new fund, it's a 10-year fund. So the actual documentation says you'll work on this thing for 10 years. In the last, decade or more, funds have lasted at least a decade and a half, right? At least 15 years. So we're going to go out and raise a new fund, I'm sure. And if we do that, then imagine extending out my venture career for another 15 years. So by that time, I'll have been at it 25. I'll do it another 15. That'll be 40 years in venture. That's probably plenty.
I mean, at this point, I'm reminded of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. I think Charlie Munger is 98, if I'm not wrong. Warren, I think, is 92, 90, yeah, 92. Do you aspire to be like those gentlemen where, they're in their 90s and pretty involved in the way they do things? Is there any aspiration in that sense or?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'd love to still be relevant and valuable to entrepreneurs in my 90s. I have other things that I certainly do and enjoy. And so it's never been the case that all I've done is work and then someday I'll retire and I'll go, enjoy my life. I do all sorts of things that are mutually beneficial. And I think those things are great. And I could easily see myself doing those into my 80s and 90s. Wow, good for them. that's pretty great. I don't have aspirations to do anything except enjoy the work I'm doing and help people be successful. And at whatever time where I'm no longer, valuable to the folks who need help, then I'll go focus on other things.
I want to push this a little bit in a sense.
Yeah.
Let's say you retire tomorrow. What do you think you will end up doing? Do you think about once I retire, I want to spend, I think some people have this that, they want to spend more time with their family once they retire. Some people have travel aspirations that, they haven't seen the world. Maybe they have spent most of their time working. Some might pick a new hobby and maybe get good at it. Do you think about all this at all, or are you?
Well, I do all those things. I have four kids, three of them live in New York City, and so I spend a lot of time in New York City. I think that the world is a magical place, and so there was an art opening a couple of weekends ago in Venice, and my wife and I flew there for the weekend. So we're obsessed. My wife and I are obsessed with this idea that art is not only beautiful, but really informs the world that we live in. And so we spend a lot of time trying to help artists be successful, trying to create and support museums that will, spread the beauty and the wisdom of artists in the world. So I'm already lucky enough. The venture business is a business that is very flexible. And so you can do all those things at the same time. I will say I don't sleep a lot, as a result of that. Yesterday, I got up in the morning. This was Sunday. I got up in the morning. I ran to meet up with the very senior executive in one of my portfolio companies in New York City. I had breakfast with him. I then met up with my son's boyfriend, and he and I went over to the US Open tennis and we watched the tennis match. And then at some point, it was too late. I had to run and hop in public transit to get to the airport. And I flew home and I landed in at about 1 a.m. and came home. And here I am on a podcast at 7:30 in the morning. So you can fit it all in if you're a crazy person. And that's certainly how I prefer to live my life.
How many hours do you generally sleep?
Oh, I don't know. I get plenty of sleep, but it's probably More like 5 than 8, I'll say.
Really? Like average is 5 hours per, like on an average, it's 5 hours, is it?
Probably about that.
I feel that's very less, no? Like, I mean, just to like maybe put some context, like, and obviously, I mean, these are individual preferences. I mean, everybody's different. But I mean, I cannot, like, even if I sleep like 7 hours, I'm like very conscious of it. And especially at like afternoon at around 2 p.m., 3 p.m., especially after my lunch. And in India here, so we have like rice, like heavy rice and like curry and all that. So after eating all that, I'm just, I have to like take a nap or something, especially if I'm like under 8 hours. So I'm really surprised that you're able to function relatively okay at 5 hours.
Well, first of all, that sounds delicious. I'm in. You know, I started out my career as a lawyer. And I was initially a litigator working in New York City, representing big companies where there was just an infinite amount of work. And so you kind of did whatever it took to get that work done. And I thought, okay, I'm going to move back to Silicon Valley to have a little bit more balance. At that point, I had 2 small children. Ultimately, I had 4 small children that I was, you know, trying to raise while I was also building a career. And so I thought in Silicon Valley, I'll have a more reasonable life, right? I'll have this more balanced life. And then I started working with startups and I just thought they were so amazing that people were so busy trying to change the world and that every minute counted that I actually started working even harder, you know? And in the late 90s, I was, you know, I was pulling easily an all-nighter or a week just to make sure that my clients were well-served. And you know, that was a little crazy. I definitely was sleep deprived at points in that time frame. Now it's really just driven by there are lots of fun things and exciting things I want to, you know, be a part of. And if trading, you know, a couple of hours sleep for doing something amazing, if there's an opportunity to trade a couple of hours of sleep for doing something amazing, I will make that trade every day of the week.
I mean, you've been doing this for close to more than 20 years. I'm curious about the kind of energy, like, you know, you mentioned that in the late 90s or in the early 90s, you were pulling all-nighters, at least on a weekly basis. How has the energy that you put into your job, do you have to like, I want to frame this right, in a sense, if I can maybe draw an athlete analogy here. You know, athletes are very, you know, they're able to perform at a very peak level, especially on a physical ability when they are in their 20s or maybe even 30s. But as age, you know, a lot of things, it becomes difficult. Let's say cardio, if you're running faster, it becomes difficult to run faster for a longer time maybe. Do you ever think about like, you know, the energy that you might have put in earlier on that either you're not able to put in or how do you compensate for that? Do you need to compensate for that? Around like the energy aspect, if you can maybe comment a little bit how you kind of think or approach it, if at all.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the lucky things that I have is a huge amount of energy, right? I am definitely a person who is, you know, wakes up in the day and it's like, okay, great. Let's, you know, let's have this conversation and this will be a conversation that will energize me. It won't tire me out. By the time we're done with this conversation, we'll have talked about a lot of things that I'm excited about. I will leave that, you know, ready to engage with the rest of my day. And I'm heading over to my office and we have our partner meeting today and we have new companies, et cetera. And so, you know, I've been, listening to a new book by my friend Sunil Gupta, and his new book is called Everyday Dharma, and it just came out. And in it, Sunil is talking a lot about preservation and what it takes to maintain your energy and to optimize to allow you to do the things that are important. And it's interesting. He tells a story. He grew up in Detroit, and an important a religious figure came to speak at his temple in Detroit, and he meets with him in the afternoon, and he describes in his book, this Everyday Dharma, pick it up. He describes that that this speaker, this famed speaker who speaks, is renowned and speaks worldwide, looks like he's half asleep And you know, Sunil as a young kid says to this guru, "Are you tired?" And he giggles, and this luminary sort of giggles, and he says to Sunil, "I'm preserving my energy." And then that night when they go to temple, here's this booming and commanding voice, this incredible person. He's like, "I wonder who that is." And it turns out that it is this individual who had rejuvenated and then was nothing but energy. And so Sunil argues that one should take these little restorative moments over the course of the day. Interestingly, that's not who I am. That's not how I live. I certainly have restorative moments, but those restorative moments usually involve a lot of energy. You know, it's not like I sit back and close my eyes and said, "I am very, very bad at that. I hate that." But you know, the other day, my wife and I spent 4 or 5 hours wandering an art fair, talking with people, talking with gallerists and artists and whatever. It was very active. It was very energized, but it was also restorative. And so I just think everybody's different. To date, I've continued to have this very high focus in helping entrepreneurs. That always is motivating to me, and finding great new entrepreneurs and running this conference I run and bringing fun and engagement and excitement to the people who attend it. And so if people keep letting me do these things, I can't imagine I'll be anything but this same, you know, like excited person that I am.
I actually find your energy like very contagious. Like I feel it's very refreshing to see as well. And I don't want to flatter you too much, but it's very it's energizing. I mean, even I like kind of get those vibes or something. Yeah,
awesome.
I want to move away from investing a little bit at this point. On your Wikipedia page, it is mentioned that you're a art collector as well. You have the habit of collecting art. Why do you think, is art collection important, or like how does art, what role does art play in your life, and why do you think that's important?
It's a huge piece of our lives. My wife and I collectively sit on 4 art museum boards. We spend a lot of time with artists and looking at art and sharing art and supporting art. And it's a great question, actually. I often ask myself this question because it is expensive. It involves a lot of time and energy, et cetera. And would we be better off spending that time and energy in helping with poverty, helping with education, all of these things that are monumentally important? The thing that drives us with art, the thing that gets us excited, is that artists are the conduits of this world in which we live. They reflect the experiences of a diverse set of people, experiences that you may not have had, but you can help understand through art. And then they create images that reflect a world in which you wish you lived, right? There's lots of racism and challenges, et cetera, in this world. There've been lack of opportunity, et cetera. And yet in the art world, the world gets presented in the best possible way, right? Artists are allowed to reflect a world that suggests that there's a fairer planet, that resources are spread more evenly, et cetera. And I find that energizing. I want that message to be spread, and my wife and I use art as the medium to say, "Hey, look, there is a better world we could have here, and it's reflected in the art of these amazing artists, and let's strive for that."
So, the impression that I have kind of about when I think about this is partly through maybe pop culture as well, and also I am like, my knowledge on this is very limited, but the impression that I have kind of received is like, when people talk about art, it's mostly like very rich people trying to be like snobbish and trying to like
show
look
off.
Look at meaning, like find meaning where probably there isn't. And that's the kind of, like, I feel like it's a very niche kind of thing where only like a very selectively few people operate in and even have the access or the ability to kind of, you know, engage in that activity per se. Do you think that's a fair analysis, or do you think like things are rapidly changing, or that what I just mentioned, that is like a caricature of what actually happens in the real world?
No, I think you have it exactly right. I mean, I think there are lots of rich people who think art is a game. It also turns out that it's an economic game, that people are able to buy art and then resell it for more than they paid for it. And so it ends up being an asset class as opposed to something that they love. And so I don't think you're wrong about that at all. It's just not how my wife and I think about the art world. It's not how we use the art that we acquire. And so my wife has been working at Stanford's Art Museum for something like 15 years. And her job is to sit at the front desk and greet people coming in. My wife is probably the only person who has ever been, you know, the person who greets people at the front desk and also sits on the board of the museum. So she sees both sides. But when there are conversations about the museum at the board level, my wife has seen exactly what's going on in the museum. And what she loves is to see communities of people who have not historically come into museums, come into that museum and see themselves reflected on the walls and get excited and energized that there is a bigger, broader worldview that's reflected in the museum. And, you know, historically, that hasn't been the case, right? If you're, you know, a person of color, if you're LGBTQ, et cetera, you'd walk into a museum and the museum would reflect a very white, very wealthy, very heteronormative, you know, worldview. And so a lot of what we support and have, and what is making museums exciting is that, you know, young Black kids from the Bay Area can come to Stanford's museum and see art that is, you know, that reflects their history. A great example is that we have a friend named Lava Thomas, and she's an incredible artist. And she created these beautiful portraits of the women who had engaged in the civil rights bus boycott back in the day. So in the United States, in an effort to try and create integration and stop this outlandish segregation in things like public transportation, a group of Black women engaged in a protest and boycotted taking the bus. And so they arrived and they knew they were going to be arrested. And so they put on their Sunday finest, right? The clothing they would wear to church on Sunday. And they went and they boycott the buses and they got arrested. And in the US, when you're arrested, they take your mugshot, which is a photo of you at that time. So there is a documentation of this moment in our American history, this amazingly hopeful and simultaneously horrific moment in the United States history, in these snapshots, these mugshots of these incredible women who are protesting these unjust laws. And our friend Lava Thomas took those images and created big portraits of these women, these heroes. And we acquired one of those portraits. It traveled around the country in exhibitions for a while. And when it came back to us here in Palo Alto, we gave it to Stanford. And it will sit on the wall and it will reflect, you know, this dichotomy of hopefulness and challenge that the country faces. And African-American kids can come into that museum and see reflected in that this moment of time in history. And it's important and it's engaging and it's inspiring. I've gone on a lot of time on this, but that's how we think about the art. That's how we want to engage with art and how we want art to engage with people. And it's not a game to us, and it's not, you know, a way to make more money and tell people how important we are. It's a way to tell people how important artists are.
So one aspect is representation. But even with representation included, do you ever think about, like, can art go mainstream? What I mean by that, just to set some context, is like, so the way I look at chess is, I don't think, so chess has a recent, chess has a relatively large people of a relatively large user base of players, but I don't think chess is a mainstream sport. And I can, like, maybe even billiards is a good example, like snooker or pool, even bowling, these are not like mainstream sports per se. In that sense, do you think, how do you think ever we will have like art? And by that, I think I'm kind, when you say art, I'm kind of thinking about like paintings or portraits or right. pieces. That's what I'm thinking about. Do you think these kind of things, through maybe funding or education, might go mainstream? Like, let's say how music is mainstream, or let's say movies are mainstream.
I hope so. Certainly that's one of our objectives. We helped to launch a museum in San Francisco called the Institute of Contemporary Art San Francisco. And part of the process was to fund this museum so that it could be free, so that anyone can come in. And then to put up exhibitions that reflect this, the beauty of a broader worldview, and then encourage a very broad swath of people to come in for free and enjoy the art. And I think museums worldwide are struggling with this, trying to make this happen. So far, like the symphony, or, you know, there are just some ballet. These things have been the domain of wealthy people, the domain by and large of white people, etc. And I think that it's incumbent upon us to make sure that's not the case, right? That it is mainstream. And I think that our efforts are making some, you know, are doing some work. You know, the Stanford Museum is free. Lots of student groups come to Stanford's museum, et cetera. But even more interestingly, you know, Beyonce had this amazing music video a short time ago that featured the artwork of some of the most important American Black artists of today in the video. So she marches down this fancy hall, and here are paintings of Black people by Black artists. And they're some of our favorite artists who are in this, you know, reflected in this video. Couldn't be more mainstream than a Beyonce video. So how do you then bridge the gap from I saw this amazing thing in a Beyonce video to I should go to the Brooklyn Museum and see Kehinde Wiley's giant portrait that's literally in the foyer? Like, you can go and see it. So I'm with you. I think it's important and hard, and we're doing our best to help in that process. And I think all galleries are trying to do the same.
Your favorite painting or art piece, if I may?
I don't know that I have a great answer to that, although I was just asked this. There's an art website and art resource called ArtNet, and they do, you know, collector profiles, and they just did one on me and my wife, and they asked that question, oh, what's your favorite art piece in your collection at the moment? And the piece I described at that point, and if you Google it, you can see a picture of the painting, is a painting by a young artist named Rebecca Ness, and it's of a gay bar in New York, and it's just extraordinarily nuanced and interesting. But to my earlier point, it's kind of like a celebration of a queer space that is where the folks, you know, Rebecca and the others who spend their time here, you know, that it is their safe and energizing and space, and it's fun to see it reflected by an artist who is so talented, and it really comes alive.
Anything that you wanted to buy but couldn't?
Always, every day of the week. we were just in New York, and there's an artist we love named Nicholas Party, and Nicholas Party makes these fun, you know, figurative paintings. And in this particular one, it's a sort of classical looking figurative painting with a dog on the lap. And my wife loves, we have a rescue dog, and we support rescue organizations. She's a dog fanatic. And it's like, oh my God, this painting is amazing. And it is amazing, but it's also more than $500,000. And so, you know, you look at something like that and say, okay, I could have a condo, you know, a townhouse, or this painting. And there are a million of those, right? David Hockney paintings are some of the most beautiful things on the planet Earth, but they're millions of dollars. So we see them every day. Instead, we just enjoy them instead of owning them.
I want to digress a little bit in the sense that in terms of like money per se, I'm just curious in general, like once people attain like a lot, once people, let's say, make a lot of money, let me just define that. Maybe let's say your expectation was to make X, but you made like 10X of that. And now you're just kind of like you're sorted, whatever that means. Is there like either a societal pressure or just, I think societal pressure is the right way here, that people might feel to give back the money for some reason? I mean,
I would hope. I don't think that's necessarily true, that's the case. But, you know, when I became a venture capitalist, I was describing the job for my mother. And we come from a, you know, family that has spent a lot of time working in industries that serve people and so, you know, giving back to the planet. And somehow that capitalist was in the title, made my mother think, oh, I don't see, you know, this is, have you sold your soul? Have you given up on, you know? And the reality is, and I remember, maybe it wasn't right at the time when this happened, but I remember having conversations with my mother and saying, you know, money has the capacity to change the planet, right? Money has the capacity to speak for the priorities you have, you know, as I said earlier, and supporting whatever things you feel are important. And so I certainly feel not only motivated, but that I have an obligation in that I have this job that does pay a lot more money than is rational, to use that money for the greater good. There are plenty of folks who have none of that compunction. You know, I talked with one friend who said that he didn't understand why I worked so hard. He's like, you're one of the hardest working people I've ever met. And then when you make money as the fruits of that labor, you give it away. So why are you working so hard? Like, you know, don't make it, you know? And this person's view was, oh, I'd rather sort of amass the money for myself than give it away. That's what I get for having worked really hard. And I said, that's just not how I think about the world. Interestingly, this individual has recently started giving large sums of money to, you know, to medical institutions. He came around to this idea, like, wait a second, actually, I think that we can make a dent in the world. And so I get it, you know. So I wish everybody looked at it that way.
I just want to push this a little further in the sense that, but maybe it's, before I say this, I think it's good to preface that obviously I don't have that kind of money. So I'm obviously kind of like speculating a lot on what I will do if I had that money. So let's be very clear. Sure. I don't have the money right now. But in the sense that I feel like it's pretty legitimate, or like I feel it's valid that people who make a lot of money like should not give it to anyone, in the sense that I feel like I was kind of sympathizing with that with your friend when he said, you know, I'm working so hard and I've made all this money, and what I will do is he didn't say this, but like if I may say, like, you know, I've made all this money, what I'll do is probably give it to my family, or you know, put in a trust fund for my kids or their kids, and you know, just let it multiply or just go on and see what happens, rather than giving it to people I may not know or causes I don't care about. I feel there's nothing wrong with that. Is that fair? Or
no, I think everybody has the right to do whatever they want with the money they make. You know, I have to say I don't have a huge amount of sympathy for this idea that wealthy people get to have their children be wealthy by virtue of the fact that they're, you know, that they get to pass money on. And none of that seems terribly compelling. On the other hand, I have four children. They're in the arts. They likely couldn't be in the arts in the way they are if they didn't have a parent who had money, right? So I understand that they're degrees of everything. I think people can do whatever they want. I think there are, I know, absolutely wonderful, lovely people who want to make a lot of money because they want to own a lot of homes and have a lot of fast cars. And that is absolutely their prerogative. I don't begrudge anyone that. But I would love for people to find a passion that allows them to, you know, to give back in some way. My wife, we adopted this little rescue dog, and my wife's life has been dramatically different and better since that day. And so we support that rescue organization called Wags and Walks in LA because it brought so much joy to her. And here's an opportunity to save the lives of a lot of rescue dogs that were otherwise going to be put to death. That makes her happy. It helps in, you know, in some small way in the planet. Like, I think everybody has that, right? I appreciate as you sit there thinking, oh, if I made more money, I have every right to hang on to it. And you do. My suspicion is if you had 10x more than you thought you needed, there'd be something where you're like, oh my goodness, my cousin has, you know, has this medical challenge and I want to help support either her or support the organization that's trying to find a cure or what. Like, everybody finds a thing that's important to them. And I don't think it's my job to tell people what is a good version of that and what's a bad version.
One more digression and then we'll surely come back to investing, which is, so I'm curious about when raising kids, is having too much money a blessing or can that be a curse?
Oh, I'm sure it's a curse. I mean, we talk about this. I have this conference called the Lobby Conference, and it's a gathering of tech execs and leaders. I have a consumer version in October. I have an enterprise version in March. 250 smart people get together and it's an unconference. So I say, what do you want to talk about? People propose a bunch of topics and we talk about them. And one of the topics that we talk about all the time is raising children in an affluent society. How can you, you know, make sure that your children have good morals and good values and work hard and all of these things? And it's always an interesting conversation. And of course, it's a very privileged conversation to have a bunch of rich people talking about, are we ruining our children? But I think that there is, there are degrees of everything, right? I think there's a capacity to create real challenges. And I have, because I have four children, I can see that it's had a different impact. When they were born, I was an attorney. I was perfectly comfortable, but I wasn't wealthy. As I was more successful as a venture capitalist, obviously it created greater economic support. And so they've seen, my kids have seen different aspects of that over time. And I think they've been affected differently, mostly by who they are, not by what they've experienced. I have kids who don't care about wealth and given the opportunity, would use that money immediately to support others. I have other kids that love stuff, you know, and think that it is fantastic that, you know, economic stability allows you to collect stuff. And I don't have any moral high ground as I sit here by a painting, which is stuff I've collected. But I hope that in the end, they still have, you know, a moral compass that says, we're going to work hard. We're going to help create value on this planet. I'm going to leave the planet at least a little better than I found it. And I'm not going to do it at the expense of anyone.
Let me bring it back to investing. So you, like I said multiple times throughout this conversation, you've been investing for over two decades now. So what does improvement mean at this point? Like, if there was a grandmaster level, earlier we took the chess analogy. Like, I mean, if there was ever a grandmaster level in investing, I think by 20 years you would get there. So what does it look like? Like, what does improvement look like? Is it only just making decisions and learning from them, or is it, or can it be done through reading, or what way is there to improve anymore?
Wow, that's a fantastic question. And one if I don't struggle with it every day, I should. Because to your earlier point about how long are you going to do this and why are you, you know, the underlying question is, are you still relevant? Are you still creating value? Why, while you're busy doing this, there's this I think, incredible fallacy that entrepreneurship and venture capital are a young person's game. And it turns out you learn a ton over time, right? When I first entered the venture business, I went home and I said to my wife, I think I'm in trouble. My partners know so much about everything. They understand networking and chips and software and, you know, development and all these things. But, you know, I've received 1,000 pitches a year for 23 years. I've met with 100 people over that time, whatever. So if you look, you do the math, it's like nearly 25,000 pitches that I've looked at where people try to explain technology. I've had, you know, 2,500 hours of education, well more than a PhD in technology and entrepreneurship and all of those things, right? So if you look at that, there's no question that you have learned a lot. Then how you can exercise that to find the best entrepreneurs and support the best ideas, that is a really hard question. And I don't know that I could help anyone answer that question. Of course, I'm trying to help answer that question for my partners every day, right? We're trying to collectively come to a good decision. And I guess my best answer to it is that I think entrepreneurship and I think venture capital are a human experience. They are about great entrepreneurs, great individuals who are creating companies, funding companies, supporting companies. And so the thing that has gotten better over the 25 years that I've been in the startup ecosystem is that I just know a lot more people. And so I have a lot more resources to help find great opportunities, support those companies, make sure that I bring together people to help their businesses, et cetera. And that just keeps getting better. But it's important if you're someone who's been in the business a long time that you're always refreshing that network, that you're always meeting new people, right? I've taught entrepreneurship both at Harvard Law School and in Stanford Business School for the last 15 years. And I meet the most incredible students who are going off to do new things. I could stop teaching and not meet that next generation, right? I could stop running my conference and not meet the new people I bring in, or I could just make my conference a gathering of all the people who'd been before, and it just becomes a party that's more like a family reunion than it is an effort to create a bigger and more inclusive community. So everything I do every day is to try and say, hey, I want to know a broader set of amazing people. I want to be helpful to a bigger, broader set of people. The more helpful I can be, the more useful, the more engaged, the more likely that someone is working on something exciting and amazing and they're going to tell me about it.
So, I mean, from your answer, I mean, I felt like meeting people is obviously extremely important. I'm wondering, it's very easy to meet people online as well, I feel, or at least connect with them online, I think. How big of a factor is like meeting on online? Like, is it as effective? Is it effective at all? Does it lead to good outcomes?
I think it's effective. I think we've gotten to the point where one can have you and I have, I feel connected well in this conversation. I actually have no idea where you're located. I don't know what time of day it is. I apologize if it's extraordinarily early or late. So you can.
So just to answer that. So I'm in Bangalore and it's I think it's 8:30 p.m. Yeah, it's
not all right. Late. That's not too bad. You're in Bangalore, which is amazing. I need to visit Bangalore. So here you are sitting in Bangalore. It's 8:30 at night. I'm sitting here in Palo Alto, California. It's 8:30 in the morning. You know, we're literally at the exact opposite sides of the planet. We're having a conversation, which you're asking, deeper questions than just like, oh, okay, what's the best company you funded or whatever. And you're asking about things that I'm passionate about ultimately in life. And as a result, I think that conversation is a much deeper, more interesting conversation. And so at the end of the day, we'll have had this connection that's fantastic. And I appreciate that. It started by you, I think, reaching out over LinkedIn, probably. Is that how we got connected?
No, I think, no, not through email, actually. We, I sent you a cold email, and from there.
Perfect. So you emailed me, which is, again, electronic, like, hey, I have this thing and you want to be part of the conversation. And as a general matter, my answer is yes to a lot of emails I receive. And then those first conversations are almost always this, right? They're almost always a digital conversation, not a physical conversation. I still think that connecting with humans as humans in a physical space is more valuable from a relationship building standpoint, right? I would rather spend physical time with people at a meal, having coffee at my conference, at a fundraiser, whatever, in the museum, than do this. And I understand that this is efficient. We can do this despite the fact that we're on the other side of the planet. And that's amazing. And I'm supportive of that. But when given the opportunity, I want to hug a human being. I want to meet you and shake your hand and have a great conversation over lunch. And then at the end of the conversation, I want to give you a hug and say, that was amazing. And I'll see you soon. And that's, of course, hard, right? You and I don't know at what time when you and I will have the opportunity to meet. It'll be great. I don't mean to diminish the capacity for us to have a really great conversation here and build a meaningful relationship. But I still would rather come to Bangalore and give you a hug.
I have a weird question in the sense that earlier we discussed, like, you know, you're obviously a very high energy person. Are there any cons of being high energy? Have you found any aspect of being high energy which is working against you?
Yeah, I can be really annoying. I mean, I do think it's an interesting question, right? If you may find this too much, right? There are people who are naturally introverted or more introspective or quieter or calmer. And I'm not that, and you can imagine that impedance mismatch could result in you finding it harder to spend time with me. And so I think that one of the challenges, of course, as a human who is trying to build real relationships, and by that I don't mean cynically, I'm not trying to collect up a bunch of names, right? I'm trying to actually meet people and see how I can be helpful to those people, right? There's this amazing young person who a family friend introduced us to or introduced me to, who is a very smart, engaged financial professional, young financial professional, but he also is an art collector and now sends me, oh, look what I got. I got this new piece of art. Oh, it's amazing. We have a conversation about it. Like, that discussion is way more interesting to me than the fact that perhaps at some point he sees a great piece of technology that he wants me to see, et cetera. I'm not trying to get to that. I'm trying to build a real relationship. If someone wants to have a quiet moment with you, then if you care about people, you should be able to quiet down, like calm down and have a quiet conversation. And I suspect that there are times when that should be my mode and it isn't, and it results in people being less engaged or finding it harder to spend time with me, et cetera. And that's a disservice to me and it's a disservice to them. And so that's probably the biggest downside of naturally being like this, of naturally wanting to say like, oh my God, what are you working on today? And they want to say like, I had a breakthrough. You know, and you're like, what's the breakthrough? And they're like, go away.
As mentioned earlier, multiple times again, you know, you've been working, this has come up, I realize this has come up a lot of times at this point.
Great.
I am curious, did you not ever try to go start a fund by yourself, like a venture fund? Like a separate venture fund. Like, I don't know. Did you ever seriously consider doing that?
There were lots of times when I thought about it, had the conversation, engage with some interesting people. There was one fund that would have been quite controversial. It was funded by controversial people. There's one fund that was with amazing luminaries that would have been fun if it had happened and didn't, you know, et cetera. But by and large, when I got to August Capital, the place I landed in 2000, it had a great reputation. We were funding great entrepreneurs. I was learning what it meant to be a VC. And so I got there when we were investing August 3, our third fund. And I was there August 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And when we finished investing August 7, I had been at August Capital for 20 years. And the founders had moved on, had retired. I was sort of, you know, my partner Eric and I were the last folks standing building this firm. And at that point, we said, do we want to raise August's 8th fund? Do we want to raise August 8th, or we want to do something different? And at that point, we decided we would raise a new fund with some new people, with a new name. And so it became Lobby Capital, based on this ecosystem of people at the Lobby Conference. And we raised Lobby One, our first Lobby Capital fund, despite the fact that, you know, I had had five venture funds before at billions of dollars under management. So to some degree, I now have done precisely that. Lobby Capital is new, exciting firm. My partner, Eric Carlborg, and I moved from August 7 to Lobby One. We brought in this wonderful investor and friend of mine named Buddy Arnheim, who joined us in the first fund. We've just brought in a great new partner named Colin Wallace, who's going to join us in Lobby Two. So it's a constant evolution, but I couldn't be happier with where we are in that evolution. And some of it is what you described, like the ability to create your own thing and call it what you want to call it. So onward.
There is this list, I think, which Forbes prepares called the Forbes Midas list, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Correct, the Midas list.
Midas list. Do you have any thoughts on the Midas list?
Oh, I have all sorts of thoughts. I've been on the Midas list, so that's exciting. You know, it's the list of the top 100 VCs, and I was in the 90s or something. So you might say, like, oh, you know, am I even on the list when you're in the 90s? I had the best string of outcomes in my career ever. You know, a short time ago, I took three companies public in the course of a couple of years. They all ended up worth more than $10 billion. It was astonishing. And I didn't end up on the Midas list. You know, it was the best evidence that I was a great venture capitalist by their measure. And yet, for whatever reason, didn't end up on their list. So I don't understand precisely what their criteria are. And I think that by and large, the list leans towards celebrity outcomes, right? So if you have funded, you know, Instacart, which is about to go public, and it goes public and it's worth $10 billion, et cetera, well, be like, oh, who was the first money into Instacart? Despite the fact that, you know, my company Bill.com, a fintech company, which is way more boring, all, you know, traded up to $20 billion, but it just didn't acquire the same kind of cachet. And so lists are lists. I'd be happy to be on the Midas list because it's fun to say I'm on the Midas list. But I'm not terribly convinced that it's in fact the 100 best venture capitalists in the world. It's a list of some great venture capitalists.
I think it's been over a decade. So let me set some context for this, because I think this is important in the sense that, so I think you're kind of famous. I think you're famous for passing on Uber and LinkedIn, if I'm not wrong. I think any conversation that you have, I think these, even if, I think this gets brought up, even if you, I don't like it or not, I think people end up bringing it up. But the thing is, like, I feel it's been almost a decade. I think it's almost a decade since if not more, since I think that event happened. And you know, here I am in 2023 still bringing it up. Do you think about that particular day that you got pitched, I don't know, whenever it was, do you still have like, nightmares is a strong word, but in the sense that, I sometimes go back to events. Now, this is not comparing at all. Like your, I mean, my events are in no way comparable to like your events, but I'm just saying like, sometimes I do go back and revisit some moments and wish, like, you know, wishing is one part, but sometimes I just like the exercise of like revisiting that moment again and again. I don't know for what, even though it brings me pain, I still do it for some reason. Do you still like revisit those moments now and then, even after more than a decade? Do you still think about it?
No, I mean, I think about it because obviously they would have been life-changing events, which, you know, I turned down Twitter, or Twitter turned me down. That's not quite true. I did not give a term sheet to Twitter. I don't know that Ev and Jack would have taken my money if I had proposed giving it to them. But I turned down Twitter. I turned down Uber. I turned down LinkedIn. I turned down a bunch of great things. I turned down Datadog, which I love and should have funded. If you're lucky enough to see great businesses, you'll inevitably turn down businesses that become big and important. And that's been true for 20 plus years. I don't really. You know, if I had not been lucky and funded some amazing companies that had been successful and gone public, then you'd probably be, it would probably eat away at you a lot more. But it's not really. I'm just looking for the next great entrepreneur who's doing something exciting, and maybe they'll be the next Uber or Twitter, and that'd be great.
Do you hate it when people bring it up, even after like I said, you know, it's been a decade and I'm still like starting off with like, you know, I keep bringing it up.
No, not at all. I mean, I think it's important. It's an important part of venture capital, right? There are VCs who think that their biggest mistakes are the deals they fund that end up losing all their money. Right? Oh, I invested $20 million and then I lost all of it. That was the biggest mistake. No. The biggest mistakes you make in venture capital are the ones you're describing, saying no to the best businesses ever. I was meeting with a potential investor in my fund at one point and had this conversation saying, you know, the founders of Uber met at the lobby conference. They, you know, they built this amazing business and then I had the opportunity to fund them and I did not. And I said to this investor who was kind of beating me up about it, hey, you know, you should have done that deal. Yeah, of course I should have done that deal. And I said, in the end, if you're trying to decide if you want to invest in me, you have to decide, will I see the next Uber and will I fund it? Will I make that investment as opposed to either not seeing it or passing on the investment? And if you think there's a possibility that I both see it and invest in it, then you should give me money. Like those would be amazing returns. And of course, I'm convinced that I will see the next set of Ubers and that I will fund some subset of them, not all of them, but enough of them that I will return many multiples of the money that you have given me. And that's what venture capital is about. So I'm happy to discuss it because I don't think of it as like, oh my God, I can't believe that I missed out on that opportunity to fund LinkedIn. I think to myself, I can't wait to see the next LinkedIn and make that bet, you know, and go help them build the business. And you always have that in your portfolio, right? I have this great, you know, still relatively small company called MaintainX, which I funded, you know, Chris and Hugo, the founders, when they were a handful of people, two people maybe, building an idea that I thought was interesting. And now it's, you know, now it's working. It's an interesting company. And I think that it has the capacity to be another multi-billion-dollar public company. So how great is that? Like, okay, it's not Uber, but it is MaintainX. And there are a lot of people who wish they'd funded MaintainX. So
so I want to push this a little bit further in the sense that did it ever make you more paranoid after, let's say, maybe let's say if I can arbitrarily take Uber as a cutoff, did it make you more paranoid in the sense that whichever deal you were kind of taking, you were like on extra high alert, like, fuck, am I missing the next Uber now? Like, did it feel like that ever?
I mean, you're always worried about that. But the reality is that the vast majority of deals that you see will not work, right? The Uber could easily have been that deal, right? That seemed interesting. You fund it. You think it would work, right? Rob Hayes, who led the seed round for first round capital in Uber, when he talks about it, he said, of course, I thought it was a great idea. Of course, I thought these were great founders. Did I have any idea that it was Uber? Like, no, don't be ridiculous. Like, yes, everything we fund, we hope is Uber or Roblox or, you know, whatever the amazing companies that first round has funded. But it doesn't mean we know that, and for quite some time, that there are these amazing businesses until they emerge and are amazing. So I'm always paranoid. I'm always worried that I'm missing something amazing, but I'm mostly paranoid about not seeing them. I'm mostly paranoid that someone doesn't tell me about the next great business so I can decide I'm going to fund it or not and make that mistake again. Because if you don't see it, you'll never be able to make the right call.
Without including yourself, who do you think is the best investor in 2023, in your opinion?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I don't think that... I think there are a lot of amazing people who are trying to help entrepreneurs be more successful, right? And so, interestingly, Reid Hoffman had this incredible run. You know, Reid's a good friend, I think he's an incredibly smart guy. And he made this decision early on that he thought social networks had the capacity to have a big impact. And so he focused on funding things that were largely social. And so he was the first investor in Facebook, and he built LinkedIn, and then he invested in Zynga, and then he invested in Airbnb, just made a set of choices that have proven to be unimaginably great, right? That those were great decisions. So oftentimes I talk with young investors who are like, well, so clearly I should pick a vertical and focus on it, right? Because it served Reid so well that he had focused on this vertical and it created great outcomes. The only problem is if you pick the wrong vertical, then you will lose all of your money, right? You will bet on all of the things that don't work and it will not go well. So the venture business is quite a precarious business. And I think there are a lot of amazing, smart people who are trying to help entrepreneurs be successful. I will say that the investors I want to work with are those who think their job is to help entrepreneurs to make the most of their business. Don't think it's about them, and don't think it's about, you know, like, oh, what an amazing venture capitalist funded this company. They think, how can I help Chris Terlicka make Maintain X a better business and cheer him along the way?
You have given a TED talk about not your fight, but I think kind of a reveal about you being dyslexic. I want to explore that a little bit in the sense how, so I think in the video that you mentioned, I think you give the example of not remembering names. Sometimes it's difficult for you to, even though you've worked with them for long periods of time, you still struggle to kind of remember names. What other impacts, pros and cons, do you think this dyslexia has had on you?
Well, let me give you an example of the name thing, because it kills me. It absolutely guts me that I have this disability, this inability to do a thing that every smart person I know can do with ease. I had, and so I literally have been just tormented by this for the last week. I had breakfast with an entrepreneur who I backed when he was in his early 20s, just building a business. And, you know, a guy named Matt Sanchez, who I love, absolutely love, and have worked with for lots of years, and was in New York, and Matt and I had breakfast, and we And we sat down and talked about it. And I know Matt extraordinarily well. And along the way, we got to talking about Matt's wife and Matt's daughter. Now, if I were not dyslexic, and I was a good friend, I would be able to refer to his wife and his daughter by their names, because people who are caring, loving friends can remember the names of your wife and daughter. I cannot. I couldn't tell you today what their names. It makes me so sad, because it suggests that I don't care. It suggests that his personal life and these people who mean more to him than anything, I don't care enough about to even remember their names, which couldn't be further from the truth. It absolutely killed me to have this conversation and talk about, I say all the time, how's your lovely wife doing? How are your kids doing? Instead of saying, you know, Pamela or, you know, Noah or whatever. I think it's a monumental problem. It makes me sad every day. So I just think it seems like a silly little thing, but it's just amazing, if you care about humans and human interaction, the incapacity to remember the names of their loved ones suggests something just not true. All right, so moving on from that.
Okay, so I have to ask this, instance, are there situations where you lose, are there situations where you forget your own wife's name?
That's a good one. I think it has been sufficiently ingrained in my head that I don't, but my children, obviously I've been with my children a long time, I named them, and so I can remember my children's names, but my children have very serious significant others. Most of them will likely get married to these individuals. And I still on occasion am like, you know, oh, what's the name of this person who will be part of my life forevermore? Now that would be a terrible, you know, like, can you imagine your future son-in-law, future daughter-in-law, and you're like, oh man, what's his name?
but in the sense that it's a problem. But in the sense that with your close friends and family, this will not be you. They will understand, right? I mean, I'm sure they will know of the issue, and they will be very, they won't punish you for it, or they won't hold it against you. I think this will be a major issue only if somebody does not know anything about you, and then they might make assumptions about you, which might hurt you in the long run. So is that fair? Or?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think if people understand it, but in that talk, that TED talk, I talk about this idea that there are quote unquote hidden disabilities, right? These things that people, you wouldn't know that, right? In fact, you would assume that I was not someone who had who was dyslexic, because I went to law school. What dyslexic would be stupid enough to go to law school, you know? But I liked law school, so I went to law school. I powered through it. So, you know, it's funny. I had a conversation with one of my sons who's reading a book about creativity, and apparently in the research, they said that left-handed children of dyslexics have some of the real advantages of dyslexics without being dyslexic, which is to say that dyslexics are often creative and sort of orthogonal thinkers, and can bring together information in ways that are unpredictable, etc. And so the book was saying that the children of dyslexics, in particular left-handed children, which is a kind of wacky thing, inherit many of the good things while still not being dyslexic. And that is my son, who is a creative, is starting a record label where he's the chief creative officer. And he was sort of like, hey, thanks for the good stuff. Glad I didn't get the bad stuff. Which, lucky him.
If I recall the story correctly, the way you got hired at August is, I think you were an attorney at a startup, and you were voicing your opinions in the board meeting, and then that led to kind of you being hired at August. Are you still vocal even today at your board meetings, or have you mellowed down?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think if you asked the folks I work with. Now, look, there's a big difference between vocal and being a jerk, right? I've tried hard to never be a jerk. I think at the end of the day, entrepreneurs are just trying to be successful. They're doing everything in their power to make good choices that will help the business be successful. So when I was an attorney, I would say things that I thought were helpful, right? I just wanted to help you with your business. So how have you thought about this? Can I introduce you to this person? How can I be helpful here? And in one instance, a venture investor didn't appreciate that I contradicted his opinion. And so he had me fired, which seems crazy to me because I'm an investor now who sits on lots of boards. I'm contradicted all the time. And it's incumbent upon me to then make the case for why I'm right or not. And so, you know, why would you bother having an attorney fired just because he disagreed with you? But in other instances, I was helpful to these companies. I remember very clearly the day that one of my clients reached out to me and offered me a job. And I said to him, "Oh my God, thank you so much. What took you so long?" Joking. And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "You're the last of my clients to ask me to work for him." You know, like all of the others had already gotten around to it. And he's like, "Oh, well, are you going to work for them?" I said, "No." He said, "So do you want to work for me?" And I said, "No, but I appreciate the idea that you might think I'm creating enough value that you'd rather have me for yourself instead of share me across a bunch of other clients, you know?" So yeah, I definitely have opinions and I definitely share them. I try and share them in a lighthearted way. I try to share them in a good-natured way and a positive way. But it's my job to sit on boards and say, "I'm not sure that's a good choice," or, "Hey, is that really an appropriate thing you're doing," etc.
Do you think as over the years it's become difficult to criticize people?
Not for me. I think there's been a moment when people were worried about it, worried about who, you know, can you criticize people and particular people, et cetera. And I've just never worried about it. My partner, Eric, says that I, you know, because I do it with kind of a wink and a joke, people are more forgiving of me, you know, that they don't take it. It's not viewed as harsh and challenging as, but look, you have to tell people what you think, and good. It's literally required by law. If you sit on as a board member on these companies, that you exercise your fiduciary duty, that you exercise the duty of care to the shareholders. So I have to do it. If I'm not doing it, what was astonishing to me about the Theranos story was astonishingly terrible job the board for that company did. They didn't ask any questions. Multiple CFOs were fired and no one said, "Hey, can I talk to your former CFO? That seems problematic," you know, etc. It's our jobs to try and help these companies be successful while keeping an eye on things that seem suspicious, that seem to be going in the wrong direction.
I think in the Theranos example, I think it also goes on to show how charismatic Elizabeth was, maybe.
Oh, for sure. No, right? Amazing. That's a hard thing to do.
On charisma, maybe not charisma per se, but want to talk a little bit about on the founder side of things. I think the aspect of confidence is always kind of spoken about. One is confidence, maybe narcissism and / delusion as well. I think I feel like these things may be required as well as founders, in the sense that to have like high conviction on your ideas and to execute on ideas where a lot of people might think that this may not work. On the founder side, I think that's largely spoken about. What about on the investor side? How much is confidence or delusion important while funding companies or being an investor? Like how much suppression of rational thought may be required to maybe believe in somebody's ideas?
Well, if you think about it, it's never obvious, right? It's never, oh, you just draw this straight line and it's a multi-billion dollar company, so I'll fund it and it'll work. If that were the case, then everyone would know how much it would be worth and everyone would fight to fund it, and the price would be something around the value of the of that thing, right? So the most exciting and the most successful companies are strange or challenging, or you have to make some assumptions to get to an investment. So I think it's important to be able to say, huh, that is a crazy idea, right? My partner Howard brought Airbnb to the firm, and we actually, the firm was split by those who were sort of the older people, the younger people. The older people were like, this is problematic because what if someone gets hurt in an Airbnb, et cetera. The younger people like, I think this is unbelievably exciting. Let's give them a term sheet, right? And it was because we were willing to suspend disbelief about this idea that someone might rent a room from another person, someone might rent out their house when they're on vacation, et cetera. You have to be able to do that if you want to be successful in investing in things that are working in the future. And it's hard. It's the more time and the more energy, et cetera, it's hard. You have to always be refreshing your point of view to say, some of these things are going to work. You know, what will make it more likely to work? Suspend disbelief about these other things, because of course, otherwise you'd never fund anything.
Thank you for your time. That's all I have for you today, David. Thank you.
Amazing. Thanks for your time.